This is episode 7 with Dr. Adam Price, author of He's Not Lazy, talking about authenticity, vulnerability, and raising emotionally intelligent boys. Welcome to Conversations with Yvette. I'm your host, Yvette Jane, mom of two, yoga teacher, and blogger. In each episode, we bring you advice from parenting experts or real talk from other parents to help you keep calm through the ups and downs of parenting. Thanks for spending some time with us. Now let's tune in. I'm excited to have Dr. Adam Price, the author of He's Not Lazy, speak to us today about how to raise emotionally intelligent boys. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe why you chose to be a psychologist?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to your community. It's a funny story because when I was, 5 or 6 years old, I decided to play psychologist. My mother was a psychologist, so that's where I got the idea. So I created a little office in my closet, and I had one of my little friends come over and draw pictures. I don't know where I got that idea. It is what psychologists do to try to learn more about people. And so he drew a picture that didn't have any arms or legs. And I said to my mom, I think there's something wrong here. And it turns out that little boy did have some problems. So I got an early start to the career.
So in your experience, how do you see boys growing up in today's culture? Are they different, same? Like, what are some of the things that you've seen culturally that they now have to face these days? And what can parents and schools do to keep them engaged as they grow older so that they can be productive and contributing members of the society?
Well, that's a very broad question. Do you think you could make it more specific?
I just see it like, now, especially with technology, I find that children across the board, are just very distracted, and it's hard to compete for their attention, even at a young age. And so I'm wondering if you have any tips and tools or for parents and schools to keep them engaged and, focused.
Well, I don't know if this answers your question, but boys and girls, a lot of people think that boys' brains are different than girls' brains. And some people even think that boys and girls should be educated separately in separate schools. I'm not a big believer in that approach. I guess for some kids it's okay. But I often think that co-ed education really helps, helps boys and girls. The problem is, and it actually probably helps the boys more than the girls, because the girls sometimes have to learn to talk over the boys. But what happens is, in terms of brain development, that boys and girls develop the same set of skills, they just develop them at a different rate and a different order. And so that rate and order generally favors girls in the early elementary years. For example, girls are better at understanding a lot of language. Boys catch up, but early on, girls are better at processing language than boys are. So oftentimes a boy will lose focus or lose interest because of that reason. The second thing is that girls' fine motor development is better than boys. Not throughout life. There certainly are some, children, teens, and adults who have good fine motor skills are either boys or girls. But early on, girls are better at cutting, they're better at pasting, they're better at learning to write. So that's another way that boys are at a disadvantage. And thirdly, girls are very much more interested in pleasing adults, and boys don't really give a hoot. And the reason for that is that girls throughout their lives, girls and women achieve social status by who they know, by what their social network is. So they're much more tuned into pleasing people and understanding the needs of others. Boys, on the other hand, gain social status by what they can do. And they're always trying to prove themselves, prove their masculinity, not to girls, but to other boys. So they do that by who can run the farthest, who can beat the video game, sometimes who's the funniest. So it's not that boys don't want to please teachers, but they're not as wired to do that. So early on, I think it's important, and many schools do this, to have a much more active approach to learning, a much more hands-on approach to learning, sitting for long periods of time. It probably isn't great for girls in the early years, but it's especially detrimental for boys. So some boys can handle it and do just fine, but other boys who may be a little slower to develop their cognitive skills, which doesn't mean that they won't, you know, it just means that they're a little slower. Everybody's on their own schedule. Boys who are perhaps have ADD and are more distracted, it's pretty easy to get disengaged. Parents are really worried about the effect of video games and computers on kids. And, you know, I've talked about this, I've been asked questions about this in all sorts of different ways. I was talking this morning in an interview regarding viral pranks and viral dares online, which is, you know, generally affects older teens. But I think parents really have to be comfortable and learn how to set limits around, especially with little kids, around video games. I don't know. It's really, you know, we'd like to draw a lot of conclusions about the effect of these things on kids. We like to say that, you know, kids have shorter attention spans because of all the viral images that they're watching in video games. You know, unless there's really some research to back that up, it makes sense. I don't know if it's true. But just like anything, it's good in moderation. You know, when I was a kid, television was becoming a big deal. Or it already become a big deal, but everybody, there were all sorts of studies and concerns about kids watching too much television mm-hmm. and what that would do to our brains. And now that just seems quaint, right? It seems mm-hmm. kind of silly. So I think the parents have to be really good at saying, this is how much time you have. And also, and especially with boys, I tell parents to say, don't just say you have 30 minutes. Say you have 30 minutes. So if you're about to start a new game and it's going to take you 20 minutes to beat and you only have 10 minutes left, I'm going to pull the plug. So you might not want to start that game. You know, it's not about use up all your time. It's about don't get caught in the middle of something that you're going to be really upset when it's over.
That's a really good tip. So you mentioned that boys are typically competitive when it comes to things like who can run the fastest, as you mentioned. So and some boys are a little bit more competitive than others. Some are just not into it, right? So sometimes I see parents, particularly fathers, push their sons a little bit more into the sports, right? And want them to be stronger, tougher, etc. And how can they do that in like a gentle, loving way so that the child becomes more confident and not aggressive?
Yeah, you know, but that's a good question, because and many parents do this not just because they're, you know, competitive themselves or want to relive, you know, some parents are like that. They want, and moms too, they want to relive their athletic life, their athletic championship, you know, when they were champions. They want to relive that with their kids, but also because I think we understand that the boys that are the most accepted by their other boys, the boys that have the most social status, tend to be the athletes. Not always. Mm-hmm. Not always are the athletes the ones, you know, there's certainly athletic kids who are not so popular. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's kind of how we see the prototypic male. I have this exercise that I do when I do workshops with parents on raising boys and on masculinity, and I ask them to say all the adjectives mm-hmm. that describe what it is to be a boy. And I usually get things like, you know, strong, confident, decisive, capable. Occasionally I'll hear a parent throw in sensitive or, you know, a good listener. But after they're done, and actually I did this with a young man last night, and he had, you know, good looking and smart and sensitive and athletic. And I mean, he had a long list. I was sitting there feeling inadequate, more inadequate with each word he put down. So then I draw a box around that. And I say, this is the act like a man box, right? This is the box that men are constrained to live in to prove their masculinity. So what do you call boys that live outside the box, right? Who don't fit that? Well, this young man happened to say normal, which was really true, because this was more about perfectionism than about masculinity. But, you know, then parents say words like weak, wimp, nerd, gay, all those kinds of, you know, derogatory terms. So I think that one of the things that motivates parents is to have their kids fit inside the box so that they'll be accepted and so that they'll be successful. You know, it is true that tall men make more money than short men. There have been studies that show that. Now, we can't control that, but we do associate tallness with masculinity. That does not mean that short men don't make a lot of money or can't, but, you know, this is an aggregate. So I think that that's part of the motivation. I think that focusing on skill development is really important. rather than focusing on winning or losing. And I'm not against competition. It's a part of life. It's important. It motivates us. But when kids are younger, especially, it's about skill development. And so it's really important to know your kid and know where their strengths and limits are, because if they're not the greatest athlete, the goal isn't to make them the best athlete, but it may be to make them a competent athlete if you can, right? Help them with what skills they can learn in terms of, you know, soccer, baseball. But there are some kids who aren't good with eye-hand coordination, and they're not good with speed. And then there are other sports, like rock climbing has gotten really big because of the rock climbing wall in Brooklyn. But that's a great thing for a lot of kids who are agile, but not necessarily, you know, doesn't take eye-hand coordination in the same way that catching a baseball does, or martial arts or things. So I think parents really have to tune into who their kid is. And listen, I have seen kids who are phenomenal athletes, phenomenal lacrosse players, who by 11th grade are done. And they could have been recruited, and their parents are so frustrated, but they're just burnt out. They don't want to do it anymore. You know, so it goes both ways.
Can you speak a little too about the teen years, like what goes on in the a teenage boy's brain, and
awful things,
and how to manage some of those turbulent emotions? I mean, to some degree, they can't even control it, right? I was reading in your book, like, there's some, you know, things that the emotions just color their world. So could you speak a little bit to that, and how to keep teenage boys engage and focus in their work as well?
Well, okay, again, there are a couple of questions there. But, you know, first of all, I think it starts early, because there's something about the way that we socialize boys that leads them away from developing really important emotional and behavioral skills that are really necessary to thrive. And these skills have to do with understanding your feelings. You know, and we say to kids, you know, man up, grow up here, shake it off.
Don't cry.
We tell boys all these things, and what we're really saying is don't express feelings. And when heard enough times, the message becomes don't feel those feelings. And so we prevent them from learning these skills, from being their own emotional detective, being able to understand and articulate how they feel. And again, the message is you're not going to need to know those skills. So I think parents have to, when they're younger, start, you know, you talked about emotional intelligence. So start teaching kids to be their own emotional detective. And to do that, first of all, it's really important. And well-meaning parents do this all the time. You know, they say, oh, that you don't have to feel that way. That's silly. Or don't feel bad. So, but what that ends up saying to the, you know, the kid is, when the kid says, my teacher doesn't like me, he really feels that the teacher doesn't like him. Now, chances are the teacher does like him, or doesn't dislike him. But if our first line is, you know, that's silly, then our kid feels like their feelings are dismissed. So I think it's important to help guide a child, a young man, a boy, through their feelings by teaching them that all these feelings have a job to do. So, for example, anger's job is to let us know that there's a violation of our rights. Something is threatening our rights. So it revs us up. It gives us the energy to figure out what that violation is and to try to fight it, right? Sadness's job is the opposite. Sadness slows us down. Sadness tells us there's something ahead that's making us feel blue and that we have to figure out what that is. Anxiety is like a danger signal. You know, anxiety is saying danger ahead, even if it's, you know, in our head. And so we have to figure out what the threat, potential threat is, what the danger is, so we can avoid it from happening. And guilt's job is to say, I did something wrong. And guilt helps us to know right from wrong, to act according to our values, and also teaches us that we're always striving to be better people. So I think developing an emotional vocabulary, talking about feelings when kids are young, is really important, because as they get to be older, then boys are better able to, you know, to have their feelings and to discuss them. The other thing that parents, you know, that's really hard for boys and for teenagers is to be vulnerable. And we often equate vulnerability with feeling needy or feeling weak. You know, vulnerability is really what connects us to each other. It really is what allows us to have relationships. In order to learn something, in order to take risks, you have to be vulnerable. But when boys and men feel vulnerable, when they feel out of control, they feel a sense of shame. And shame is different than guilt. Shame's, you know, I didn't include shame on the list of things that, you know, emotions teach us, because where guilt says I did something wrong, shame says I am wrong. And that's just never true. That's right. Never a reality that's accurate. So I think that helping boys to be vulnerable, helping them to be in touch with their feelings, is really important. And we do that again by teaching what feelings are. We do that by making it okay to make mistakes. I'm giving you a lot of information, you know.
This is fantastic.
And I can talk about that in a moment too. But you know, I believe that the opposite of masculinity is the femininity. I believe the opposite of masculinity is authenticity. You know, authenticity is having a choice to step outside the act like a man box, maybe even to live outside it. And it also, authenticity also means that when you're feeling vulnerable or afraid, you don't have to feel like less of a man. So one of the things that I think is really important there is making it really okay to make mistakes, and to allow kids to fail, which is much easier said and done when kids are in elementary and middle and high school than when they're adults, even though there's so much pressure, even from a young age, especially in New York City, to, like, you know, get kids on the right track, in the right preschool, in the right private school, in the right public school, so that they can get into the right college, et cetera, et cetera. So I have a list of things that parents tell themselves before they let their kids fail. I only want the best for my child. I can't let my child fall behind. It's much easier. It takes less time if I do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think parents have to ask themselves, what is on the line for me if my child does not perform well? What if my child turns in homework with errors on it? God forbid. Mm-hmm. And what kind of parent would I be if my child failed to play well, get good grades? So I think telling kids making a mistake doesn't mean you are a mistake. And, you know, if it's okay to make mistakes, it's okay to have feelings. And if a parent responds with empathy, then a boy isn't going to feel ashamed when they feel vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, and then I'll get to your question. I'm talking your ear off, but then I'll get to your question about what goes on in the teenage brain. But I lost my train of thought.
You were talking about the
Sorry. So the other thing that I tell parents along these lines is to foster independence. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when we do so much for kids, helicopter parenting, snowplow parenting, you know, in Scandinavia, they call it curling parenting because you sweep all the obstacles away, whatever you want to call it. You know, we're giving the child the message, we're spoiling the child, but we're also giving the child the message, you can't do this for yourself. So I always encourage parents to do this exercise. Write down everything you do for your kid in 1 week, whether they're an eight-year-old or an eighth grade. And it could be a long list. And at the end of the week, take a look at everything that is on the list and take a big red pen and cross off everything that your child can do for themselves. Stop doing it. Whoa. And then look at the things the child can do part of, and let them do that part of it. That's called scaffolding, by the way, which is supporting them when they have an emerging skill.
Mm.
And then do the things for them that they can't do, that you need to do for them. So I think that's really important. Did you want me to talk a little bit about the teenage brain?
Yeah, just because eventually they'll be teenagers. And I think there's a point where things switch, right? There's a noticeable difference between, like, the way that they act, because I think as teenagers, and you said it in your book yourself, that they think they're grown up, they think that they're capable, but actually sometimes they're just not. And so,
well, right, yeah, it's really a fine balance to help them to feel capable but to set limits. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at limits as like a fence you build around your child. And when they're young, you want the fence to be really tight, because you want them to be able to be safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as they grow, that fence has to get bigger so that they have more room to be themselves and to experiment. But when they get to be teenagers, you never want the fence to be so high that they can't climb over it every once in a while, because that's how they learn. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how they understand things. And what's happening in adolescence is the brain is really a mess. And it's a mess because it's going through an entire rewiring. Two things are happening when teenagers hit puberty on a cognitive level. We all know it happens on a physical level, but there's a whole lot of stuff happening on a cognitive level. And I'm not just talking about hormones. Hormones are there. Hormones do their damage, and, you know, also do their good. But there's these two forces that collide in the adolescent brain. The first one is that the brain is becoming rewired. The human brain is really amazing. The brain cells aren't connected, right? They don't connect to each other. Information is transmitted through electronically charged neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. Many people hear serotonin because it's related to mood. There are a lot of them. The reason for this is so that the brain can be really fluid and flexible and change and move, so that as you're learning something, there's a connection between two brain cells, actually it's millions of brain cells, and as you don't need that information anymore, that connection can easily be broken. It's not a physical break, and then the cell can go connect to someone else, some other cell. So part of what happens is something called pruning. If you stretch out brain cells, you know, one-on-one, it will cover the entire perimeter of Manhattan. You know, that's how much is stored in our brain. So pruning takes place throughout life, but at certain critical times where brain cells are actually lost, not because of alcohol. It doesn't make you more stupid. It actually makes you smarter, because it's just kind of a process of refinement. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the brain is being rewired. It's actually not being rewired, but the cells that are there are being given a coating, an insulation. It's called myelin sheath. And what that does is it allows information to be transmitted more efficiently, more smoothly. And it really is most targeted in the prefrontal cortex, which is just behind the eyebrows. That's where all planning takes place. That's where, you know, think before you act takes place. You know, teenagers are ready, shoot, aim. And that's because this whole part of the brain is going through reorganization. So at the very moment when the brain is not so good at saying slow down, think, plan, there is this explosion of dopamine receptors. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that brings us pleasure and draws us towards pleasurable things. So it's released with drugs and alcohol. It's released with sex. For me, it's released with ice cream these days, you know, a nice piece of chocolate cake, whatever it is. And teenagers have an explosion of dopamine receptors. So they're always looking for, you know, feed me with something interesting, pleasurable, new. And the purpose for this is to get so that they'll get out into the world and learn things and experience things and, you know, eventually make babies. Evolution doesn't really need you to be, you know, 28 to have a baby, right? They'd rather you be 40, meaning there's a team. I don't know what I'm saying. Evolution's not a group of people, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So these two things collide, right? Interest, novelty.
The Wi-Fi was in and out. Okay, I think you're back.
Okay. Don't take things personally. Don't take what teens say to you personally. Of course, that limits. That's right. Different than, oh my God, my kid hates me. Oh my God, my kid is so disrespectful. Mm-hmm. Don't take the sulkiness personally. I think that diffuses so many situations. Mm-hmm. The second thing is to avoid power struggles. If you get into a power struggle with a kid, your way or their way, I promise you they're going to win. Mm-hmm. Because you're just trying to create order in the house, peace in the house, trying to create some structure for them. They're fighting for their autonomy. And mm-hmm. so they will do whatever it takes to win. So you're not going to hopefully start swearing and screaming at them and breaking furniture, but they might, you know? Because they're going to escalate until they get their way. So the way around this is to avoid the power struggle. Mm-hmm. And this works with young kids too, especially 2-year-olds. So rather than say, you can't do this, you say you have a choice. It's up to you, which respects their autonomy. Your choice is you can clean your room and then go out with your friends, or you can stay in your room and keep it a mess and then not go out with your friends. It's up to you. Now to us, that really sounds like it's semantics and like a trick, but teenagers really hear this. Thing is, if they choose to stay home, you gotta let them stay home in a dirty room and not clean it. So I think those two things are really important. And then the third thing is really to, and this is true of kids of all age, but you know, listen before you talk. Mm-hmm. Ask questions, try to understand a teen's perspective. Just, you know, understanding someone's perspective and giving and treating them with empathy doesn't mean you agree with where they're coming from. It just means you understand it. And when kids feel heard and understood, they are going to be much more open to whatever you have to say. But if they don't feel like you hear them, and they don't feel, and they feel like you dismiss, going back to what we said before, their feelings or whatever, they're going to tune you out.
Right. I think that's true of all little children as well, right?
I think it is. Yeah. Yep. Yep. It applies.
Oh, thank you so much. That was a lot of information. Fantastic tips and tools to help raise the next generation. Thank you so much for your time. Folks, He's Not Lazy can be found on Amazon.com, and I'll also put the links on this podcast. And
I appreciate that. I also have a blog on Psychology Today called The Unmotivated Teen, and I think everybody should do yoga.
Thank you so much. This is so fantastic.
I am a big yoga devotee. It's kept me going through many difficult times. Parents should do yoga. Kids can do yoga. Mm-hmm. Yogic breathing. It's all good.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening to Conversations with me, Yvette Jane. If you like our show and want to know more about Dr. Adam Price, check out his book, He's Not Lazy, on Amazon.com, and his blog, The Unmotivated Teen, on Psychology Today.